Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC from the Aspen Ideas Festival today. As we continue to record out of doors, maybe you can hear the roaring Fork River, or the birds, or the wind, perhaps the sightseeing airplanes going by. One of the participants is Helene Gayle, the president and CEO of CARE, one of the world's largest relief and development organizations, as you probably know. And they've been in the news a lot this year, most recently because President Mugabe's government banned CARE and all other NGOs from operating in Zimbabwe. Helene Gayle, public health expert and veteran relief aid worker, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you.
So first of all, tell me what the situation has been like in Zimbabwe, if we can start with the news, and how CARE has been involved.
Well, we've been working in Zimbabwe for several decades now, particularly helping to supply food, health services, particularly HIV and AIDS, working in education and developing agriculture. Over the last few months, increasingly, the work has been much more focused on the humanitarian side, the immediate relief, and not as much on the long-term development side, which is what we at some point like to be able to get back to. It's been a very tense situation. As you mentioned, we were the first NGO, but subsequently other NGOs were asked to stop their work. There were accusations that we were supporting the opposition or doing political work. We're an organization that doesn't get involved in politics. Our work is really to help people on the ground. So right now, our workers are at home. Basically, all work operations have been suspended. We're keeping a shadow workforce in our offices. But right now, we're waiting to see what will happen on the political front.
What a shame. What impact do you think that has on the actual delivery of food and the actual well-being of individuals in Zimbabwe?
Well, we think it's going to have a huge impact. Our program served about 2 million people total, but suspending the food aid means that we're not getting food to about a half a million people who are in desperate need of food relief. And if you multiply that by the other NGOs who also aren't able to work, I think this could reach catastrophic proportions.
Where is that food?
Well, we don't know where the food is. The food was in country, but we no longer have control over whether or not that food is going to military, whether it's going to people who need it, whether the food that should be going to school children is getting to school children, or where it's going. So we just don't know at this point.
And assuming that you did not campaign for the opposition, as Mugabe accused you of, why would Mugabe want you out? Why would they single out CARE, first of all, his government, and why wouldn't he want you there at all?
Well, it's hard to say why we were singled out. Within a day, other NGOs' work was suspended. So I think you start with an NGO. We're one that has been there for a long time, working with communities, trusted by communities. So, I think it may have just been a random first choice. I think the real concern is whether or not this is a government that has the interest of its people as a priority, and whether or not they are concerned about organizations who, in fact, are helping the people and putting that as our first priority. So I think, it raises a lot of concerns about what the intentions of that government is.
You know, some people who critique the entire field of relief aid and development as it exists today say that what some of the countries in Africa and elsewhere in the world need much more urgently than relief is anti-corruption reform, that they need that first because corrupt governments control so much of the aid that arrives, even in better times than we're experiencing in Zimbabwe, and then use it for their own ends. Do you agree?
Well, I think you have to separate out humanitarian relief. So what do you need to do to keep people alive during a crisis? And then what do you do on the long-term development front? And I definitely agree that on the long-term development front, it's critical that we're not only looking at provision of services, but that we're also helping to strengthen civil society on the ground, helping people recognize their rights, helping governments do better about their responsibility to their citizens. So even if we're doing a project that focuses on water or health or education, we build into that a an approach that really looks at how do you get people to use that as a lever towards better governance, less corruption? How do you teach citizens about the lessons of corruption and the fact that if they band together, they can actually act as a force against corruption? So we definitely believe that these underlying causes of these underlying factors are oftentimes the real causes for why countries and peoples and communities don't move forward. And if you don't tackle those, we're not going to have the kind of long-term impact. But I think it is important to separate out what you do in an emergency situation and how do you approach long-term development.
That comes back to the Mugabe situation, though, doesn't it? Because even though you have a strict policy to steer clear of politics, the kinds of things that you were just talking about are essentially political, maybe not partisan, but they're political.
Well, some people would interpret them as political. We think that it is helping people build a strong civil society that is part of building a open society. And clearly having an open society is important, where citizens are informed of their rights, where you work with the government to be much more responsive to its citizens.
But it's a fine line there, because that could certainly be seen as threatening to some of the authoritarian regimes in the world, which probably not coincidentally are often some of the most poor countries in the world.
True. I think that sometimes that does present a dilemma. And I think it's why in some countries the non-governmental sector is seen as a threat. I think what we want to make clear is that our work is not political. Our work is really in the interest of improving the lives of the poorest of the poor. And to do that, it's more than just providing services. It's more than just giving a person a fish, or even teaching a person to fish. It's really looking at how do you revolutionize the fishing industry? Why are there no fish in the stream to begin with? And if you don't look at some of those factors as well, then development won't be sustained, and it will be short-term, and it will be putting on Band-Aids.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC at the Aspen Ideas Festival. My guest right now, Helene Gayle, the president and CEO of CARE, who is here at the conference. And, you know, some of our older listeners may remember CARE from their childhoods, even CARE packages and all of that, and think of it in one way. I wonder if people today in the field see it in a different way. You talked about relief and development in the same breath, right from the start in our conversation so far. And I wonder if humanitarian aid, this whole field, has changed very much over the years.
Well, I think it has changed a lot. We started out, as you said, as an organization that gave out commodities, food and other critical needs for people after World War II. Now, we've moved to an organization that still does relief work, but as part of our long-term commitment to communities. So we do most of our relief efforts in communities that we are already working in on the development side, really looking to bring about sustainable change. But those communities are often the same communities that do have conflicts, or natural disasters, cyclones, droughts, et cetera. So our commitment is a long-term commitment to communities, looking at what's the best way to provide sustainable approaches to development, looking at kind of a three-pronged approach that looks at basic needs, but also looks at the position of people in society. Why are they excluded? Why are they marginalized? And what are the factors for that? What are the kinds of policy obstacles that keep people and communities from moving ahead? So we think that you need to look at all of those different factors if you're going to have sustainable development, as opposed to just getting relief to people in a short-term way.
And can you ultimately be a force for good in that respect? Because, you know, there are critics out there who say aid to developing countries does more harm than good, because it keeps a sort of relief political industrial complex in business rather than fostering a permanent solution.
Well, I think it can be. More harm, and it can be self-perpetuating if you don't take an approach that ultimately will put yourself out of business in the long run. That's our goal: is that to not be necessary, to develop the capacities within communities so that they can have sustainable change. And it's working differently and working in a much more of a partnership mode. So we work a lot more now with the private sector, for instance, looking at models that will generate revenue, that will help in the long run to build economies. We're working a lot with NGOs on the ground to build their capacity so they have the skills when we are no longer necessary, and working with the government to build their capacity so when we develop programs that demonstrate what it takes to make a difference, that we can then they can be scaled up around the country. So we really are working differently and hopefully in a smarter way, in a way that will sustain change over time.
What role does development specifically targeted at women play in that?
Well, we think that there's huge potential in really putting a focus on girls and women in societies for two reasons. First of all, women and girls bear the brunt of poverty. They make up 70% of people who are living on less than a dollar a day. But we also know that if a woman has added education or increased income, it creates a virtuous cycle that goes beyond her. Her children are more likely to get educated. They're more likely to get to access health services. She's more likely to have a smaller family that drags less on the family's economy. So women and girls, when they have the capacity, it gets plowed back into families and communities and really creates a virtuous cycle and can really be an engine for long-lasting change.
Helene Gale, President and CEO of CARE, with us on WNYC in Aspen. We talked about Zimbabwe. Was CARE also involved in Burma or Myanmar when that government started rejecting aid after the cyclone?
Yes, we were also in Myanmar because, again, we had a presence there for several decades and several hundred workers on the ground. And so we were one of the first relief organizations that was able to get started. Now, there were impediments to movement originally. There was also impediments to bringing supplies in or even bringing in people from outside who we needed to increase our capacity. Some of that's been improved, and we're now working and have already assisted some 200,000 people in Burma, Myanmar with food, clean water, and other emergency supplies. Clearly, there are still concerns about freedom of movement and the ability to get supplies and people in and out. But that has changed, and we are able to bring relief to people there. It's one of the first times in an emergency situation, however, the politics did come into play.
And after the cyclone, relief workers reported that they expected there would be widespread disease and starvation due to the junta's slow response. But now the New York Times is reporting that that expectation may have been exaggerated and perhaps on purpose to apply more political pressure to get foreign aid into the country. Do you know that to be the case?
No, I really can't speak to whether it was exaggerated. I think given the initial reaction, it wasn't unreasonable to be concerned that in a situation like this, that where aid workers didn't have the ability to move freely, bring supplies in, that we could have had a much more catastrophic situation than has been the case. Luckily, there was pressure brought to bear, whether or not that was necessary, but things have eased up. We have been able to provide relief to people in need. At the same time, there was still a lot of loss of life, almost 80,000 people with about 50,000 still missing. So it's been a very, very serious situation nonetheless.
The situation in Myanmar also renewed the debate about the idea of a responsibility to protect. And this is the doctrine that the UN adopted in 2005, which is that if a government engages in criminal behavior or really negligent behavior against its own people, that that state forfeits its right to sovereignty, in a sense, and the international community has a responsibility to intervene. Where do you come down on this issue of a responsibility to protect? Does CARE have a position? Do you?
We don't have a position officially as an organization. You know, again, we're a non-political organization and don't necessarily develop specific positions on issues like that. I guess I would just say, from an organization that tries to preserve life and do what's in the best interest of individuals, there may come times when the rights and lives of citizens have to come before the issue of sovereignty. But I think that's only with a fair amount of discussion, because there's a slippery slope, and it's very easy to start picking out countries that you do or don't like and decide that they're not doing right by their citizens. So I think the onus, the burden of proof has to be on the international community and working in close concert.
Before you go, I'm asking all my guests here, if you've gotten a chance to go to other panels than pertain to your own field here at the Aspen Ideas Festival and have heard any ideas outside your own realm that you might want to repeat or amplify?
Well, I try to use events like this, forums like this, to actually go to things outside of my own domain because obviously that's what I know the best. And I think some of the technology ones have been particularly interesting. I went to one yesterday on games and how games for good, I think it was called Games for Good. And
Sandra Day O'Connor was on that panel, wasn't she?
On that panel. She was great. And I think this whole idea of how gaming has such an incredible role in learning, in teaching people on things, everything from peace and security, basic education. We're looking at it as a way of teaching young people about the issues of global poverty. So I think this whole area of technology and how we can use it in a much more creative and much more social fashion is one that I'm very interested in, because for an organization whose work is so far from the people who contribute to it, you know, the American people may never see the woman in Ethiopia that we work with, but if we can bring that woman through technology to a community and engage them more in what the real issues are, I think we can build a much more enlightened society.
Through technology, even through a game?
Even through a game.
Helene Gale, public health expert, veteran relief aid worker. She had been with the Centers for Disease Control previously and the Gates Foundation, now the president and CEO of CARE, one of the participants in the Aspen Ideas Festival. Thank you very much for being with
us. Thank you.